Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be
Esto es KBOO Portland, la radio comunitaria impulsada y empoderada por voluntarios.
This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
One, two, three, four.
Ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
KVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. Want to bring attention to what's been going on in Iran. Of course, there was a lot of headlines because of the bombings that took place, Israel followed by the U.S. Many people were concerned as to what the far-reaching implications of these actions would be. We've heard stories about destroying a nuclear site. It's brought a debate about whether or not a country has the right to accrue as whatever weapons they deem fit. Others have said the current administration in Iran is pretty brutal and a human rights violator. But the question that gets raised is whether or not the U.S. and Israel took the actions that they did because they were concerned about the citizens of Iran. Joining us to help us sort through some of this is Professor Stefan Zunes, who's been at USF since 1995, teaching courses on the politics of the Middle East and other regions, nonviolent conflict resolution, U.S. foreign policy, globalization, and the politics of war and peace. He's the founding director of the Middle Eastern Studies Program. So there's nobody more qualified to help us through this myriad of questions than you, sir. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
A little bit of Iran 101. I think most of us, to be honest, couldn't even point it out on a map. We've heard the name. Some people get Iran and Iraq confused. We don't know the name of the leaders. We just know that, you know, from the cursory news reports, that it's a place that has been a thorn in the side of Israel. It's been a thorn in the side of the U.S. It's been a country that has been able to supply monetary and sometimes physical support for organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah and others. I mean, that's really about it, you know, the headlines. Let's do a little bit deeper dive into it. And I guess starting, you know, just looking at Iran and the recent actions that were taken, a little bit of Iran 101.
Well, let's start off with, it's a large country. It's physically, it's about the size of Western Europe, has 90 million people. Formerly, it was known as Persia. And it's been around, it's been a major regional power on and off for over 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so this idea the United States has that they can push it around like it's some kind of small, Caribbean or Central American, you know, country that the, U.S. can just bully into doing our way, is pretty naive. And, you know, the government in power is pretty reactionary. It's not, you know, very popular among its own people. But, they have a lot of pride in their country, and they wonder why, you know, other countries can, you know, reprocess uranium and have a civilian nuclear program, and they can't. I mean, personally, I don't like nuclear power anywhere, including the United States, but, they figure they have that, right. There are a lot of legitimate criticisms about the Iranian regime, the political repression, denial of equal rights for women and religious minorities, support for extremist groups, you know, lack of really free and fair elections. But, you know, you could say all those things about Saudi Arabia as well. In fact, I would argue Saudi Arabia is worse in every single one of those categories. But Saudi Arabia is the U.S. ally, so we're cool with that. You know, right. So, legitimate criticisms about the Iranian regime, to be sure. But that's not why the U.S. opposes it. The way the U.S. opposes it, because it dares challenge U.S. and Israeli hegemony in the Middle East. And that really is what the bottom line of the hostility is about. Because even if they did build a nuclear weapon and, you know, becoming the 10th country in the world to have those weapons, you know, the idea that suddenly launch some kind of suicidal first strike seems, you know, rather silly. The U.S. policy is that we can bring nuclear weapons into the region. Israel can have nuclear weapons. Pakistan can have nuclear weapons. India can have nuclear weapons. But Iran can't even have a civilian program that has the potential of forking off into a military direction someday.
Let me ask you this. Professor Zunez is with us this afternoon. The narrative that I heard is that Iran is not completely 100% at fault in terms of its current government, that we had our hands in this when we did regime change. You know, way back in the days, we saw that there was a government that was there, democratically elected government that was going to nationalize its oil. The U.S. felt that this was a violation of their particular interest and did a regime change, one of many that came about at that time throughout Africa, Latin America, and other places. And so the offspring of that is the type of government that we have. And as you pointed out, we seem to have no problem when it's a country like Saudi Arabia, but we have a problem all of a sudden, or at least we present that to the general public, that these guys are bad guys and the good old USA is coming in to rescue, but we're slow to the rescue in a lot of other places. For me, just seeing the hesitancy in the US when South Africa had its apartheid regime, and, I remember those days of Ronald Reagan talking about constructive engagement, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we kind of reconcile that, or do we, is that history that, or that narrative that I pointed, is that relevant to what's going on today?
It's certainly relevant. The democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh, which was a secular government, was overthrown in a CIA coup in 1953, and we brought back the Shah, that's essentially the emperor, who had been in exile, and put him in power. And supporting the SAVAK, the dreaded secret police. You know, they crack down on virtually any dissent. And in the 26 years that followed, engaged in really savage repression, and largely decimated the secular, leftist, liberal, nationalist opposition. But the one area they couldn't totally eradicate was the religious opposition. And so when the Iranians finally had their revolution in like 1978-79 against the Shah, which is overwhelmingly nonviolent. I mean, it was mostly the classic kind of civil resistance, strikes, massive demonstrations, that kind of thing. They overthrew the Shah, and the power vacuum was filled by the Ayatollahs. These are the leading religious, these are the religious leaders in Shia Islam. They're kind of like, Ayatollahs are kind of like cardinals in the Catholic Church. You know, they don't just oversee, you know, houses of worship, but, you know, they have hospitals, schools, mutual aid, you know. So they were the one part of civil society that sort of survived, and so they are able to kind of take over, even though, you know, most Iranians were not, you know, did not subscribe to their very conservative interpretation of Islam and the imposition of a brutal theocracy that came about. So, you know, basically, if the United States had not intervened back in 1953, there would not have been an Islamic revolution, and we would not have had this the crisis that we have now.
But again, we need to underscore, it was the threat of nationalizing their oil that became the issue.
Yeah, well, that was a piece of it. It was actually a British oil company that they nationalized. So it didn't affect any U.S. oil companies per se, but we were obviously concerned about the precedent that it would set in terms of neighboring countries like Saudi Arabia and others, where the U.S. really, you know, did have oil interest. Also, the instability that resulted from the British and U.S. led sanctions and boycotts against Iran because of their nationalization led us to be concerned that the Communist Party of Iran, known as the Tudeh, you know, might take over. You know, so, you know, there's also just kind of this, you know, Cold War paranoia that, you know, certainly played a role as well.
Under the Ayatollahs, is oil nationalized now?
Oh, yeah, certainly. You know, they're not able to sell some of it because, you know, the U.S. has put sanctions on their oil and has a policy that if any other country that has, you know, trades with them, they'd be punished as well. For example, Total, the French oil conglomerate, was working with the Iranian oil company, but the U.S. said, you know, we basically will, you know, shut down all your gas stations here in the United States and punish you in other ways if you trade with Iran. So since they had more business in the U.S. than in Iran, they have joined the boycott as well. So, you know,
How far-reaching are those sanctions? Is it something that, you know, say a country like China or Russia would be like, well, do what you're going to do. We're a sovereign nation. We'll trade with whoever we want to trade with.
Yeah, some of the larger countries that can, you know, can resist that kind of thing, go ahead and do so anyway. But it has led to a lot of economic hardship. And remember, the sanctions were reimposed by Trump in 2018 when he tore up the 2015 Iran nuclear deal that Obama and five other national leaders had negotiated with Iran with the approval of the United Nations.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off. I don't think many of us knew about the deal that was torn up. Can you break that down for us?
Well, basically, the international community was concerned that Iran was enriching uranium in their civilian power plants, you know, to a degree that could potentially make nuclear weapons. So they negotiated a deal where it said Iran could continue to enrich uranium like other countries are able to do, only it would top it off at a 3.67 enrichment level. So that's plenty for nuclear medicine, it's plenty for nuclear power, but way, way, way short of the 90% you need to actually build a nuclear bomb. Iran also agreed to essentially destroy this nearly completed nuclear reactor that could have produced plutonium, which is another way of producing a nuclear bomb, and agreed to rigorous inspections, which covered every aspect of nuclear development, from the mining and milling and processing and power plants and any site that was at all suspicious, civilian or military. I mean, it was very, very thorough. No way physically possible for them to build a nuclear bomb. But then Trump ended up, even though Iran was following the agreement 100%, Trump threw it out and reimposed sanctions, and Biden didn't refuse to go back to it. And so Iran started producing their enriching their uranium to a higher level, again, well below what it would make to get a nuclear bomb, but certainly a lot more than the previous limits. And so now, and of course, Trump's idea that he could make a better deal. I mean, I actually spoke with the then Iranian foreign minister back in 2019 when I was in Tehran, and he talked about, I mean, he and John Kerry sat down like 50 times, you know, to go over line by line by line. And Trump's attitude, oh, I could just do it like a business deal. I can bully my way and get my, what I want, was totally unrealistic. And so, again, if Trump had not broken off the deal, this war wouldn't have happened, and none of these other things, you know, would have happened.
Why didn't Biden go back to the Obama agreement?
Well, I think the reason was that the Iranians, you know, having destroyed billions of dollars worth of nuclear equipment and fuel and things like that, were concerned that, hey, we could do this again, and then the Republicans come back in power, you know, a few years later, and then they reimpose sanctions. Yeah, we don't want to be, you know, we want some guarantees that if the U.S. reneges on this again, that you will pay the cost of the destruction of all this kind of equipment and fuel, and Biden, you know, was unwilling to do that.
Wow. What's the beef with Iran and Israel? Because it seems like Israel has been chomping at the bit to go at Iran. And realistically, considering that Iran has always been a power throughout the centuries, in the millenniums, is this something that is a wise approach?
Well, the thing is that, Iran does not border Israel. It's well over, you know, 600 miles away, and it's not an Arab country. It is.
It's not an Arab country.
No, no,
many people
no.
Think it is.
Yeah. There's a small Arab minority, but there is an Azeri minority and a Kurdish minority, but slightly over half the population are ethnic Persians. They speak Farsi, which linguistically is actually closer to English than it is to Arabic. But Iran, since the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the U.S. invasion in 2003, and more recently when the Syrian people overthrew the Assad regime in Syria, Iran really is the only regional power, you know, challenging Israeli hegemony in the area, and U.S. Israeli hegemony. And again, it goes back to the thing that neither U.S. nor Israel, you know, want a country to that can challenge them. I mean, it's kind of like, remember how you know the U.S. has been totally obsessed with Cuba all these decades, or the Sandinistas in Nicaragua in the 1980s. You know, neither of them were a threat to the United States. Neither of them had much in the way of natural resources or markets or whatever. But their crime was that they defied us. That they defied the hegemony, and this is sort of what the thing with Iran is. That is their big concern. Because even if Iran developed a bomb, Israel would have more than sufficient deterrent against it. We have thousands of Russian nuclear weapons pointed at us, Chinese nuclear weapons, whatever. But you know, we say, hey, we have this nuclear deterrent. So you know, again, Iran's not going to have a suicidal strike against Israel. But what if they did get a bomb? You know, they would, you know, maybe Israel and the United States would think twice the next time they start bombing and invading some other Middle Eastern country. And so really, this is what the issue is. And again, I no apologetics for the Iranian regime. They're bad news. I do not want them to get a nuclear weapon, you know, this kind of stuff. But that, I mean, that's all pretty clear. But again, that's not really, you know, the crime really ultimately is that, you know, this the U.S. doesn't believe in non-proliferation as a principle, because again, we have no problem with Israel, Pakistan, and India having nuclear weapons. In fact, they also are not abiding by UN Security Council resolutions. Yet we provide all three countries with nuclear-capable jet fighters. We even signed a nuclear cooperation agreement with India. You know, basically, the U.S. attitude is nuclear apartheid. You know, we can decide who gets to have nuclear weapons and who doesn't. And we feel so strongly Iran can't even have a civilian nuclear program that has the potential, theoretically, someday, of getting a nuclear bomb.
I think in principle that is angering, because it does come across as you said, and I like that, nuclear apartheid. It does come across as bullying, not on principle, but straight up just bullying, which means that people will suddenly side with Iran, which has caused some debate, you know, because people say, well, look at the government. And it's like, yeah, but in principle, should they be allowed to have that? At the same time, I couldn't help but wonder if we would feel that way if it was another country. I remember when Israel, another country that was reluctant to step away from the apartheid regime, there was talk that South Africa under apartheid was going to get nuclear bombs. And we felt like, you know, all the stops should be taken to smash down on it, primarily because of the, you know, the oppressive government that was there. And so I guess I'm just trying to wrap my head around, like, how do you kind of parse this out when you don't like the current administration? You see that they're very clearly an oppressive one. And at the same time, you don't like bullies, and you can recognize a bully when you see it.
Yeah. I mean, actually, the United States did not object to South Africa developing a nuclear bomb. The international community did. I mean, there's a joint Israeli-South African test that was spotted by a U.S. satellite, and the U.S. actually covered up for it because it would embarrass U.S. policy, since we were, you know, opposed sanctions in South Africa and everything. But when you try to impose a regime of haves and have-nots, and it just makes the have-nots want to try even harder. I mean, let's look at if you're an Iranian, and you see your country listed on the axis of evil. That was George W. Bush's terms, you know, for Saddam's Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, and they say, you know, this is the axis of evil, and they know, and Iraq gets rid of its nuclear program, brings in inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, confirm that they got rid of them all, but Iraq gets invaded anyway. Their government overthrown, their country occupied. North Korea, by contrast, throws out the IAEA inspectors, starts building nuclear weapons. They're still in power. What lesson do you get from that? You know, maybe you should have a nuclear deterrent. You know, so. You know, so again, the double standards, the hypocrisy of the U.S.
Why didn't we bring that sort of smoke to North Korea?
It's hard to tell. I mean, you know, if they are. I'm not an expert on that part of the world. I can't you know quite explain it, but I think that. You know, I think, frankly, the Middle East is considered very important. Iran has all this oil. Iran is an actor that supports various groups that are also challenging the United States and Israel. And there's also this kind of vendetta that you know, here's a country that was closely allied with the United States under the Shah. We can't forgive them for having overthrown him and then held on to, you know, American hostages, 50 American hostages for 444 days, you know, from the U.S. embassy, that whole episode. But, you know, there really has been, it seems, this irrational obsession with Iran, you know, for a long time. And it's hard to defend, frankly, on a, you know, strategic or political level, but you know, this is the reality that with, again, this total obsession with Iran. And I mean, the thing is that, yeah, they do some nasty things. I mean, despite their anti-imperialist rhetoric, they've engaged in kind of imperialist machinations themselves in the region. Yet their role is greatly exaggerated. I mean, Hamas is not an Iranian proxy. they're a Sunni group that grew out originally grew out the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. Very, very different than the Shia Iranians. Hamas and Iran are on opposite sides in the Syrian civil war. The one Palestinian group that the Iranians did support some was Islamic Jihad, which is actually a rival of Hamas. Some small rockets and some funding has come from Iran, but most of the funding to Hamas has actually come from places like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and United Arab Emirates. These are Sunni Arab states that are ironically are backed by the United States. So I think during the Cold War, I mean, yes, the Soviets did nasty things for real in Eastern Europe and Afghanistan, places like that. But then we would exaggerate, you know, their role, saying, oh, they are responsible for the Sandinista revolution or the revolution in El Salvador or Vietnam or Angola or whatever, you know, denying agency to the people who, you know, might have felt they had reason to make revolution. And we're similar thing with Iran, that we grossly, that, yeah, they do some nasty things in their foreign policy and some of the groups they support, but we grossly exaggerate them to act like, you know, they are the biggest problem in the Middle East, that they are causing all these acts of terrorism and resistance and things like that, as a way of shifting responsibility from U.S.-backed governments, you know, like Israel, that have been doing plenty of things that have gotten people angry enough to engage in these kinds of terrorism.
Right. Well, we've definitely been a nasty player all around the world. You know, and that should, you know, not go, should not be swept under the rug. Let me ask you this. You just said you were in Tehran, and I guess because they point out the oppressiveness of this government, how does the average Iranian, if you're able to ascertain, how do they feel? What's it like for the average person that is there? Is it a place where folks are trying to escape and go into exile? Are people just tolerating, living, you know, under those conditions? Traditionally, which is why I'm asking this, when the U.S. has wanted some sort of regime change, they have pretty much got behind and funneled, you know, resources and help amplify the messages of the opposition. Venezuela would be one place, you know, that we could point to and see how that has played out. And, you know, there's a number of other countries, primarily through South America, where the U.S. is meddled, not necessarily sent arms in, but have definitely, you know, found an opposition to the government in charge and pretty much amplified its opposition. Is that happening in Iran?
Well, there's certainly opposition in Iran. The vast majority of Iranians do not like the regime. Even those who believe in an Islamic Republic in principle are recognizing that the regime, in fact, is neither. I mean, it's kind of like in Eastern Europe, you know, by the 1970s, you had even socialists opposing the communist governments there because they saw them as no longer really promoting socialism, but their own power and control. Mm-hmm. And it's a similar thing in Iran. They're very strong opposition to the regime, but that doesn't mean they like the United States intervening. Now, there've been periodic uprisings, again, overwhelmingly nonviolent, for greater rights and freedoms and the like. And of course, the regime says the U.S. or Britain are behind them, which is not really true. I mean, under Trump and Bush, there was some limited support for opposition groups, but not very much. And most of the legitimate Iranian opposition groups, on principle, do not accept U.S. or foreign funding because, you know, for the very reason they're doing it for themselves, not for a foreign power, and it also obviously works against them. Propaganda, it gives propaganda for the regime, but a lot of the stereotypes. I should also mention that, you know, the women, you know, have to have their head partially covered, and the leadership is pretty much all male. The vast majority of college graduates, including graduate students, are women. In fact, 70% of people in STEM fields in Iranian universities are female, compared to only 30% here in the United States. Wow. So it's a highly educated population. And it's not like Saudi Arabia, you know, where women have to be covered, you know, head to toe and are even more rigidly segregated and things like that. But there are thousands of tiny acts of resistance every day, from clandestinely pouring you some alcohol underneath the table to freshen up your drink at a restaurant, to satellite dishes behind the cisterns, getting Western television. You know, any Western movie is available, you know, on a bootlegged, you know, DVD within days. Young couples, you know, they will figure out ways, you know, by flashing their TikTok address on a little card to make a clandestine rendezvous somewhere, because, you know, unmarried, you know, people cannot to get together unless accompanied by relatives, you know, according to the morality police. So again, thousands of tiny acts of resistance going on every day. But the idea is that this idea that, oh, they're waiting for the United States to rescue them or something like that, that's not true at all. They want regime change, but they want to do it themselves and not on behalf of a foreign imperialist power.
I'm glad you broke it down like that. I think quote unquote American exceptionalism has us believing that what we have, everybody wants. And you know, just my travels around the world, I find that that is definitely not the case. Folks are kind of like, y'all are cool, but I'm not really checking for you like that. You know, sure, I'll take some of the accoutrements that we have, but don't get it twisted. I'm not waking up in the morning saying, golly gee, I wish I was over in the U.S. That's the goal. And I think we've been led to believe that. And it informs the way that we react or don't react to certain types of acts that the U.S. takes. We think, well, they're doing a good job rescuing them. And as you said, no, we want our own agency. And I think that's hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around. Professor Zunas, as we close out, where do you see things headed right now? You know, what do the political winds say for you? Or do you have a crystal ball that you could look at and say where we're going to be 6 months from now, a year from now, 5 years from now with this dance that we're doing with Iran?
Well, I think it's in the interest of both the Israeli government and the U.S. government to continue focusing on Iran, in part because it takes attention away from what Israel's doing to the Palestinians. You know, this genocidal war has killed tens of thousands of innocent civilians. You know, people are being starved. And civilian targets continue to be hit with devastating results. You know, when it comes to Israel versus Palestine, there's growing sympathy for the Palestinians. But when it's Israel versus Iran, you know, given the nature of the regime and that kind of thing, Israel tends to get more sympathy. And so so the more the focus is on Iran, the less on Palestine, and therefore the better for U.S. and Israeli policies. So I see a situation where we will continue to manufacture this crisis. I mean, you know, Bush said, oh, Iran was in weeks of developing a nuclear weapon. No, they were a couple, you know, U.S. intelligence confirmed that they were at least 2 or 3 years away from that, and they hadn't even decided to even try doing that yet, you know. So this is not a crisis. There was no urgency for Israel to launch this unilateral attack. It was clear violation of the United Nations Charter, no strategic reasons, and similar the U.S. bombing. Because again, if the concern really was about Iran getting a nuclear weapon, we would have simply gone back to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which Netanyahu opposes and that Trump refuses to do. And so I could see a situation where the Iranians start digging out the destroyed entrances to this underground nuclear facility or something, and Israel say, oh, they're rebuilding their nuclear program and doing so we have a right to bomb them again. Trump and bipartisan congressional leaders will defend it, as they did the Israeli attack earlier. And you know, we'll have a low-level war of Israel periodically bombing Iran and Iran periodically sending missiles, you know, into Israel. And so we could see, indeed, a protracted a conflict. Meanwhile, Palestinians continue to get slaughtered in Gaza, and Israel keeps colonizing and going and engaging in a slow-motion ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. You know, I think what we really need to do is to build a stronger, you know, anti-war, you know, movement that makes clear that supporting this kind of militarism is wrong, and that it's, if we really want to support nuclear nonproliferation, we just need to go back to the Iran nuclear deal. Unfortunately, right. Because we're so distracted about saving democracy in our own country, you know, we may not have the resources to build as big a movement as we should. But I think we really need to hold our politicians, including the Democrats, accountable. I mean, a number of Democrats have said, "Hey, we don't think Trump should have bombed without getting permission of Congress, according to the Constitution." But very few have said, you know, hey, what Israel did in launching this war is totally, totally wrong, and we need to go back to the Iran nuclear deal.
You know, I said that was the last question, but as you were talking, what comes to mind, is there concern that there will be a clapback or an unfair profiling of Iranians here? And what I mean is, you know, immediately afterwards, and I felt it was just posturing. We were like, you know, police chiefs are meeting all over in there. You know, they're patrolling the bridges and patrolling the subways and mm-hmm. patrolling the ballparks, fearful that there's going to be a soft, quote-unquote, soft terrorist attack by enraged Iranians. That, in turn, you know, tends to focus attention on Iranians that are here in the U.S., many who actually may be conservative, in my viewpoint, and mm-hmm. actually been like, yeah, do whatever you can to get rid of that government. You know, I'm not going to shed mm-hmm. a tear about it. But that's one concern, that all of a sudden we start demonizing Iranians here under the guise that they may be harboring secret terror cells. And the other question is, do we see boots on the ground suddenly, you know, mm-hmm. going toe-to-toe with Israel in the Middle East?
Well, in terms of the Iranians, you know, there was some really horrible targeting of Iranians and Iranian Americans during the hostage crisis back in 1979-80. Mm-hmm. But you know, we do have a large Iranian diaspora community in the United States. They are actually, you know, pretty well educated and professional, and they, you know, virtually all oppose the regime, though I would argue, my impression is the majority do not want the U.S. to get involved directly. But I do think, you know, this supposed threat is, you know, that, well, the Iranians are going to support terrorist groups attacking the United States could be used, you know, as an excuse for crackdown on civil liberties in general. And not necessarily targeting Iranian Americans, but in a sense, you know, targeting all Americans, saying in regard to the supposed terrorist threat, we therefore need to crack down on free expression and everything else here. I mean, again, the Iranians have done some nasty things, but there's no evidence they've ever plotted to commit acts of terrorism on U.S. soil. Regarding the question of boots on the ground, I don't see an invasion of Iran like an invasion of Iraq. Iran is three times as big, both in size and population, unlike the southern three quarters of Iraq, which is pretty much flat, open desert. Iran is very, very mountainous. You know, again, logistically, an invasion, you know, would not work, and I don't think that's really in the cards. But I do see the U.S., you know, using its air power and naval power. We certainly kill a lot of Iranians. We killed over 1,000. Israel and the U.S. killed over 1,000 Iranians during that 12-day war, the majority of whom were civilians. That could dramatically increase. Also, you know, the Iran could retaliate in other ways by, you know, they have this kind of token attack of a handful of missiles on a U.S. base in Qatar, which didn't hurt anybody. But, you know, they could have done a lot more. And they could do a lot more if the war resumed and the U.S. was involved. We have over 40,000 American troops, you know, within a couple hundred miles of Iran who'd be vulnerable to missiles, drones, and other things. We have the U.S. Navy in the Persian Gulf that could be targeted. Indeed, Iran could disrupt shipping in the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil supply sails through. And you can imagine the impact that would have, you know, not just on oil prices, but on the global economy as a whole. So we can see, so again, I don't see boots on the ground invasion, but there are all sorts of other scary scenarios that we need to think about if things escalate. And that's why we really need to challenge U.S. policy now before it gets to that point.
We've been talking with Professor Zunez from USF. He's the Director of Middle Eastern Studies at that university. I want to thank you for joining us. Hopefully we can have you back, you know, to lend some more keen insight. If people want to follow your work, get a hold of you at their website or, you know.
You can check my website, stephenzunes.org, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-Z-U-N-E-S. I'm also on Substack and Blue Sky and Facebook and Twitter. And I also have an email list. You can find my email address at some of those places. You can just send me an email and ask to be put on the list, and you can get my articles, which come out every month or so. These are usually short policy briefs on U.S. Middle East policy and other issues. And I welcome people to be in touch.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman, Chris Juwan, Cam. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else should just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Need and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah!
Bellevue! Come on! Check out!
Why every obvious if they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till they ready from the steel grave beef. Say please! Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making his peace. Say some peace to their lovers, our neighbor to please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Let's go!
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
It don't matter the year, 'cause it's just another number. As long as we all get down to the funky drummer. Music hitting your heart, 'cause I know you got soul.
Get down.
It moves through your spirit, taking full control. Voices are rising and the truth is flowing. Revolution beats loud and the fire keeps growing. We demand what is ours, the right to be heard. Freedom of speech is the power of our word. Fight the power, rise and resist. Fight the power. We can't dismiss. Fight the power. Our voices ignite. Fight the power. We're claiming our rights. It's freedom or death. No compromise. We fight for justice
under open skies. What we need is awareness. No, we can't get careless. To fight oppression, we must stay fearless. What we need is knowledge. We must stay relentless. Gotta stay on point and move with clear intention. Fight the power, rise and resist. Fight the power, we can't dismiss. Fight the power, our voices ignite. Fight the power, we're claiming our rights. And plus I'm amped. Most of my heroes never appeared on no stamps. Cause I'm black and I'm proud, and not afraid to say it out loud. Fox News was a hero to most. Elon was a hero to most. Trump was a hero to most. But they never meant ish to me. Straight up racist, it's simple and plain. Mother them and John Wayne. Fight the power, rise and resist. Fight the power, we can't dismiss. Fight the power, our voices ignite. Fight the power, we're claiming our rights.
Chaos in California. Look at what you see in California. What is unmistakable is the aura of chaos. And I speak not here about the demonstrators. They are, in large part, reacting to government intrusion into their lives, the kidnapping of children, of old ladies, of gardeners, of really poor working people trying to build a life in the richest country in the world. So where does that chaos come from? It comes from some of the richest people in the world. It comes from billionaires. It comes from Donald J. Trump. And you think only Elon Musk wants to rule the world? No. It is characteristic of billionaires to want to control everything around them, because essentially they're insecure about losing that which gives them and their lives distinction, and that's money, that's property, that's wealth. And this is wealth at war with the poor. And some of the poorest people, not just in California, but in the United States entire. And these are people who just want to find a way to feed their families, their children, and build a life in the richest empire in the world. And it's also about divide and conquer, because that, at its base, is the essence of politics. Not addition, division, destruction, divide, fear. Those are the notes and registers of this moment. And only protest, cohesion, unity, care, and love can defeat this chaos. May it be so. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The rain falls hard. An old man sleeps, no roof, no guard. Under the freeway, lost in cold. Somebody's father left out alone. What mother could picture this sight? Her child forgotten, lost to the night. $1 million homes lying away, but for him there's no shelter, no place to stay. What happens to us when we fall from grace?
Fall from grace.
When the world turns its back and we lose our place. Why do the evil people never ever die? While the good ones suffer and ask the sky, is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive? As this old man shivers in the dead of night, rich people passing their lives full of light, they turn a blind eye, too busy to care, while he's left to freeze in the cold, cold air. Why do the evil people never ever die? While the good ones suffer and ask the sky, is there no justice for the ones who cry? Will we ever rise? Will we ever thrive? Why do evil people keep on living? Why so many who are good keep forgiving? One day, someday, things got to change. We can't keep suffering. We can't remain the same.
Let us ha, hey, hey, ho, 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 knock radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Ha.
Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Spin. Hard Knock Radio takes the mic. Let the dialogue begin.
From the heart of the culture, where the beats do sway. Hip-hop politics and culture rule the day.
Hard Knock Rockin' on your radio. Hard Knock Rockin' on your radio. Hard Knock Rockin' on your radio. Let's go. Let's go.
Daily dose of the real. Where the news unfolds, stories untold in the mainstream's hold. From the streets to the suites, putting fools on. Where the news unfolds, stories untold in the mainstream's hold. From the streets to the suites, putting fools on blast, breaking chains of silence.
Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
Do you like discovering new music and reconnecting with some older but perhaps forgotten favorites? Then look no further. Tune into the listening.